It's Wednesday, August 26, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington in New York, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Nick Correa.
Thanks, Ash. Back in March, the Fed released a memo laying out how they would be supporting the flow of credit to households and businesses. As part of their efforts to achieve that, they announced that they would be reducing reserve requirements to zero for the time being. Between unprecedented levels of quantitative easing and a reserve requirement of zero, banks' excess reserves have grown rapidly. Of course, to encourage the flow of liquidity, rates have been cut close to zero, as have the interest rates paid to banks on excess reserves. As a result, there was a major credit glut, especially in the beginning, with large corporations and businesses clamoring to secure debt to finance their operations as they faced extreme slumped demand. The Fed's liquidity injections that began in March helped assuage investors' and officials' fears of a tightened credit market. But are credit markets tightening? There's some data that indicates that they are. The July 2020 Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices covers the terms and demand for bank loans to businesses and households for the past 3 months, corresponding approximately to Q2 2020. Banks reported that they had tightened their standards for commercial and industrial loans, and also reported weaker demand for C&I loans overall. Banks have also said that there was tightening across all three major categories of commercial real estate loans: construction and land development, non-farm, non-residential, and multifamily. Same thing here with demand on commercial real estate loans, weaker overall. For households, banks tightened on all categories of residential real estate loans, while demand, especially for GSE-eligible mortgages, is picking up. Banks are also tightening on auto loans, credit cards, and other forms of consumer loans, as demand for these forms of debt are plummeting. This is where the rubber hits the road. Will all of this excess liquidity from the Fed find its way into the economy? Or will credit markets continue to tighten and potentially stifle economic growth in the long run? And with that, I'll send it back over to Ash and Ed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Thanks, Nick. Welcome back, Ed.
Yeah, well, it's good to be back. And I have a few things for you. As always, I have to talk to you about football, a.k.a. soccer. You heard about Leo Messi wanting to leave Barcelona. I'm sure you know about that.
I know nothing about that.
And, you know, the reason I always do this is because we've got to get you up to speed. The new season is coming. He's the one of the most prolific players, he and Cristiano Ronaldo, in football today. So you've got to follow that, Ash.
When does the season start?
You know, I'm not sure because of COVID, but it usually starts actually right now. Usually the beginning of the season is now, but they're delaying it because they just ended the Champions League. So they just ended last season. And that's actually the reason that Messi is looking to leave Barcelona, because the Champions League ended. His contract says that at the end of the season, he can leave. So he's trying to leave now. We could go on. Like, if you were a real soccer fan, we could talk about this for the full 30 minutes.
I'm working on it. And talking about things that I do follow, what are you looking at today in markets?
Yeah, so, you know, backing into what Nick was talking about, I wanted to speak about where we are transition-wise, because that bank lending standards tightening is very interesting with regard to my thesis that September and October are the time frames that we really want to look at. I just got off the phone earlier today with Sri Kumar, who I'm going to talk to tomorrow about his thesis with regard to long duration bonds. And I think that he also is looking at this whole nexus of what's happening in the real economy versus what's happening in the financial economy. I think that the real economy is definitely showing some signs of rolling over. And the real question is it going to continue? And what sort of impact is it going to have on asset markets, particularly on bond prices and on equity prices?
So, Ed, we talked a little bit about, you know, you and I both have worked in fixed income before. For people who aren't familiar with the duration on bonds, what does that term of art mean?
Yeah, so basically duration is the average maturity, the average length of time that you get your money back. So, for instance, if you have a bond and it pays a coupon that's a interest rate of, say, 3%, you get 3% payments every 1.5% payments every half year out until, say, 10 years. And then you get a balloon payment of the full $100 100%. Somewhere in that range is going to be the median maturity of the payments that you're getting. And the longer it is before you get your balloon payment, the longer the duration of the asset is. So if the asset is a 30-year bond, then the duration is longer. And actually, the lower the interest rate, the longer the duration as well.
Yeah, so it's basically the time that it takes to pay off the price of the bond from the internal cash flows. And in terms of the interest rate, it's the coupon rate that's determining, because it matters what the cash flow on the bond is relative to the point where you bought it at. And I know that there's a lot I've forgotten here, like the difference, for example, between Macaulay duration and simple duration, totally lost to memory.
Yeah, I mean, the simple thing is that the lower the interest rate, the longer the duration. So that's why you're getting even longer duration now that interest rates are down. And also the longer the maturity, the longer the duration. And longer duration assets are more volatile relative to changes in interest rates. So if you're really bullish, you know, someone like Gary Shilling will tell you you want to go into zero coupon strips, which are longer duration assets, the longest of the long duration, because those are going to give you the most upside. But there's a double-edged sword with that.
Yeah, the duration on a zero coupon is coterminous with the maturity because it's not paying off any interest payments over the course of the life of the bond. You pick it up all at the end. But you hit on really what the key point is, which is that the lower the coupon payment is, the longer it takes to get paid back the principal of the bond that you invested, or the purchase price, I should say.
Yeah, and so the way I was looking at, I had this whole thing about risk assets being a play on duration, that the momentum trade was really a duration play. The lower that we've been going, the longer the duration of assets were, and therefore people were moving out the risk curve in equities as well. But the reality is that how low can you go? You can go to zero, but can you go into negative rates in the United States? I'm not sure. So at some point, a lot of people are thinking we're going to back up. The rates will back up. And given the fact that rates are already so low, if and when they do back up, it's going to have a very negative impact, not just on equities, but potentially also, or not just on bonds, but also potentially in equities, because equities are basically a play on duration.
And for people who don't follow the cross-asset correlations as closely as you do, explain a little bit about how that expresses itself, the correlation between the duration trade in bonds and U.S. equity prices.
Yeah, so there are two ways that I'm thinking of it. The first way that most people are thinking of it is in terms of the discounted cash flows of equity, the cash flows that a company spends off. So that a bond, when the bond yields are lower, the discount rate of those cash flows is lower, and that means that the flows that are further out in maturity are actually worth more because they're discounted back at a lower amount because the discount rate is lower. I'm also thinking of it in terms of the Peter Atwater K-shaped recovery type of thing. That is that there are certain assets which are really bid up, and then there are assets that are not bid up. I believe that the assets that are being bid up are being bid up as a proxy for what I would call secular stagnation. That is that people want to get into these assets, because interest rates are low, because we're in a secular stagnation world. But obviously, if that's not the case, if for whatever reason we get into a stagflationary world or somehow we get a vaccine and things turn around and then suddenly we have growth, then the bid for those assets is not going to be as strong as it otherwise would be.
You know, it's amazing we are not hearing more about secular stagnation, because this is, it seems as though it could be one of the theories that could describe very well the simple, the absence of growth that we've had in the economy and some of the challenges that we're having with things like income distribution and income inequality.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, I think that we'll see whether or not secular stagnation comes into the fore because of this tightening of business lending standards that we were talking about earlier with Nick. Just because he was mentioning this, I was looking at some other information. I saw on Reuters, actually, there was an article from August the 3rd that was talking about the banks tightening their lending standards in Q2, that loan demand dropped in Q2. The article is basically saying that demand for nearly all types of loans also fell. That is consumer loans, business loans, real estate loans in Q2. So the question then becomes, in a world of secular stagnation, where you also are going over the fiscal cliff, which is where we potentially are in the September to October timeframe, what does that mean in terms of the real economy? And then what is the knock-on effect into asset prices in this bifurcated K type of situation?
Yeah, I look forward to hearing more about C&I lending, commercial and industrial lending, and CRE lending, commercial real estate lending in the months to come as a metric of what's happening in the real economy.
Let's see if we can pull up a chart here just to give you a sense of how gangbusters this whole thing is right now. Because when you mentioned that, I think it's interesting. If you look at the GDP Now numbers, which is what the Atlanta Fed releases every few days, they update this. It's a nowcast, which means that they do this statistical correlation to say, if things were to pan out the way they are up to this point, our numbers spit out this number for GDP growth for this particular year or for this particular quarter. And so the number that they've spit out is actually 25.6% for Q3. That's for the data that go up through August the 18th. The interesting bit, however, is that the nowcast of the third quarter, real residential investment growth decreased from a ridiculously high 60.7% to 39% in their last update. So these are numbers that are rolling over at a ridiculously high rate, to the degree that we continue to see this, what I would call a fiscal cliff, that is the lack of fiscal impulse into the economy, a complete shutdown of fiscal spending to deal with the pandemic. Those numbers are going to roll over in a big way. So 25.6% is going to go down to 15%, 10%. And I think even for Q4, you could see a negative number in a worst case scenario.
Yeah, another negative number, right? It's coming off about a 33% contraction. And by the way, we should probably add, all of these numbers that we're talking about here are being expressed SAAR. So that's a seasonally adjusted annualized rate. So basically what they're doing is they're adjusting the quarter to coincide with what it would happen if it were a full year at that rate.
Right. And you know, so the conversation that people are basically having now in terms of the dichotomy between the real economy and the financial economy, a lot of it has to do with money growth. So if you look at, say, M2 money growth over time, what you'll see is that money growth is in the, you know, it's 10% or less. It's been much less. It's been less than 5% right before we had this crisis. And it just shot through the roof up to 25% during this particular time as the Fed went bananas and just was injecting money like crazy. And so,
but Ed, what's the punchline?
The punchline is that, you know, not everywhere is it a monetary phenomenon, right? Milton Friedman said inflation is any and everywhere a monetary phenomenon in terms of the impulse to the economy. I'm thinking in terms of not necessarily real GDP, but nominal GDP and inflation. We're not getting inflation. We're not getting a huge spike in nominal GDP per se. Why? Because money velocity is just plummeting. And this goes back to the secular stagnation play. If you look at the velocity of M2 money stock, what you see is, you know, through the last two cycles, it's been going down. It went down in the cycle after the internet bubble burst. It went down again after we had the great financial crisis, and it's plummeted over this particular pandemic. And that what that's telling you is that you're pushing on a string. It's telling you that on a broader scale, this whole thing about bank tightening lending standards and the fall off in the fiscal cliff is really going to have a pernicious effect on the economy unless we deal with it very soon.
Yeah, that's extremely well said. And that really is the key point there. I knew if I teed that ball up, you'd absolutely hammer it. And it's spot on, right? That is the notion that with collapse of the velocity of the M2 money stock, the inflation bears who see you know, skyrocketing Weimar Germany style inflation around every corner have been wrong time and time again. And because of that phenomenon, exactly as you describe it.
Yeah. And, you know, even the Fed, I mean, we think the Fed's pouring it on, right? Because we see those numbers for M2 money stock growth. But the reality is actually the Fed, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, it really topped out in June and it rolled over through July. It's come back to a certain degree, but the Fed's balance sheet is lower now than it was at the beginning of June. So I think that, you know, we are in a period now where the Fed's not going turbo. We have the fiscal cliff rolling over, and then we have stocks hitting new highs on the NASDAQ and the S&P on a regular basis, and individual stocks like Tesla, which have, you know, gone up four times in this particular year. When I was talking to Sri Kumar, who I'm going to speak to tomorrow on live on RV Pro or RV Plus, he was telling me, look, you know, if you have this dichotomy between the real economy and the financial economy, when do you decide, okay, now's the time to reverse course? Is it at 17 times forward earnings on the S&P, or is it at where we are now, 25 to 26 times forward earnings on the S&P? So that's what we're trying to figure out. What's the impulse that tells you? I've been saying pretty consistently that I think September and October, the fiscal cliff is going to be a huge impulse if it's not fixed. So this is a good time for us to think there's going to be a transition. It's either a transition from the K-shaped economy, that is that you have a reweighting of assets within your portfolio, or B, it's just going to be a wholesale a sell-off in risk assets as people flee to treasuries.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah. Tesla right now trading at 1,100 times trailing 12-month earnings. Right. I mean, so, you know, there's aspects of this particular market that seem just completely delusional and out of touch with reality. Also, higher, as of yesterday, at least I haven't checked today, higher total enterprise value, higher market cap than Walmart.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Than Walmart, in fact.
And Walmart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I should add, by the way, that the chart that you were referring to is the total assets of the Fed balance sheet. And you can see it, the movement you're talking about was rolling up from about $4 trillion in 2020 to about 7.1 or so trillion as a high. And, you know, it's interesting, even that chart, which is striking when you look at it, because it goes totally parabolic in Q3 20. But even that chart, when you look at it from 2004, we were at $800 billion in total assets on the Fed balance sheet. And then we jumped up pretty dramatically. Well, we thought it was dramatically, at least at the time, from about 800 billion to around 4 trillion. And now up, nearly doubling again.
Yeah. And a lot of people are there, you know, when we talk about the K-shaped recovery, they're trying to put their heads around from a macro perspective, what's this saying? Not only what's this saying, but what's the macro paradigm that I could use, and therefore, from a timing perspective, how can I understand when there are shifts in that macro paradigm? One of the macro paradigms that I think works for most people when they're thinking about it is the dichotomy between fiscal and monetary policy. I'm definitely going to talk to Sri about this, you know, the so-called monetary offset, because really what it boils down to is that the Fed's going to pour it on when the fiscal authorities aren't pouring it on. So the thinking is that the Fed has a mandate to go for inflation, an inflation target, and they also have a full employment mandate. This is something that they've been told by law they have to meet, so they're going to go after it. So to the degree that inflation's below target, to the degree that unemployment is higher than target, they are going to pour it on. That means they're going to do whatever it takes in terms of lowering interest rates, buying up assets, et cetera, to try to meet those targets. If the fiscal authorities are not pouring it on at the same time enough to get you there, the Fed is going to offset that pattern. And so they're going to pour it on even more. So the reason we went from 800,000 to 800 billion, sorry, these numbers are getting
It's hard
large.
To say. I mean, right, it's just insane. Right.
From 800 billion to 4 trillion is because the fiscal authorities needed to be offset. They weren't pouring it on enough, if you could believe that. Even today, it's the exact same sort of thing, is that the Fed really, is monetary offset going to happen? It has happened. And what happens when monetary offset happens? Asset prices go up. There's displacement out of certain asset classes into other asset classes. We have the whole thing I was telling about, you know, duration proxies, flattening of the yield curve and the duration going up, and therefore asset prices going up. But the real economy stagnates because the mix between fiscal and monetary policy is not as good. So that's where we are right now. In my view, we're at the mix where fiscal policy is down, monetary policy is up and potentially could go up more. The question then still remains, is that bullish for risk assets, or is it a point where what's happening in the real economy is so dire that even risk assets have to roll over?
Yeah, and it also seems, exactly to your point, Ed, it seems like more to come. Right, the speculation today, the scuttlebutt, is that tomorrow, sort of virtual Jackson Hole, that Jay Powell will talk about average inflation targeting. You know, for those who aren't down with the Fed speak, it basically means that the Fed can let the economy run hotter. It's framed in a way that sounds kind of neutral. That, you know, well, we're going to target an average rate of inflation, but really what they're saying is that when inflation rates, and they use PCE as generally their benchmark, when inflation rates sink below their 2% target, they're going to allow the economy to run hot in order to compensate for it and to create an average inflation rate of 2%. Now, look, my feeling on this is only about pushing things to the upside. Clearly, when we get negative prints on PCE or CPI, the Fed is going to act.
Right. And, you know, we all know, because over the last 11 years, 12 years, they've missed their inflation target over and over again, that the Fed really doesn't have a handle on inflation. When they have an inflation target, you do have to wonder to yourself, A, can they hit the target? And B, do they have the tools to hit the target? Or is it just that, you know, this is a proxy for them to be able to increase asset prices, increase employment as a result of that, increase output as a result of that, et cetera. That's what I'm thinking. And so, you know, going back to the original question from there is, what does it take in the real economy? How bad does the real economy have to get before what the Fed's doing by trying to push up asset prices rolls over? I saw a chart that you sent, actually, of the potential storm surge flooding of this. So, you know, that's yet another, what I would call, black swan. How are you thinking about that?
I mean, it's just a flock of black swans. It's 2020. I mean, the black swans have become the white swans. I expect, you know, these things to happen at this point. It's been a very difficult year in many ways, and there's a tremendous human toll. Look, I went up to the National Hurricane Center website at NOAA, and I read through just some of the summaries there. And here are some of the phrases that they're using to talk about it. Quote, unsurvivable storm surge, destructive waves, catastrophic damage. Obviously, tremendous human cost to people who are in the region. You're talking about not just lives lost, but massive property damage, massively disrupting to people's lives. But in addition to that, we all know that that region, a great deal of refining and transportation capacity for U.S. Oil and gas production. You know, you immediately think of oil prices, WTI up fractionally, Brent down fractionally on the day, doesn't seem to be priced in. But yet again, another potential impact to the U.S. economy, precisely to your point. And let me just add one other thing, and something that came from you earlier this morning, which was the piece that Janet Yellen wrote, I think it was in the New York Times, with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And here's the quote. Basically, what the piece is about is Janet Yellen saying that fiscal policy needs to do more, that we really need more accommodative support from the fiscal side to go along with what the Fed is doing. And here's the quote. We weren't in the room, so we don't know exactly why congressional negotiations broke down or what it will take for them to restart. But we could not be more confident that our economic prescription is the right one. The Fed stepped up. Once again, it's Congress's turn. So it's interesting to hear Chair Yellen making reference to the Fed stepping up and her high degree of confidence that their policy is the right one. The idea being that, look, there's a lot of skepticism now, more broadly. You and I have talked about it, and there are certainly people who are thinking about this, many from the libertarian perspective, center-right perspective, and others, frankly, who are questioning how long we can have interest rates at zero or near zero without creating massive macroeconomic distortions. It seems to me, and obviously, you know, Chair Yellen has spent her life studying this, and when we second guess it, it's just looking at it from multiple perspectives and trying to understand what's happening. But she's basically saying, all in.
Yeah, definitely. She's saying we're already all in and we're prepared to go more. But at the end of the day, the skew is going to be so large, it could only continue to create what we've already seen thus far. And by the way, let me just say that I saw an article about New Orleans and Louisiana evictions. Actually, the moratorium on evictions is going to lapse at the end of this month. So not only are you looking at this massive storm that's coming to them, but also, you know, they would already be evicted anyway, many people. So, you know, without the fiscal authorities there, that whole sector of the country is going to be crushed. My thinking is about COVID in particular. You know, if you have people who are harboring, not in place, but in massive gymnasiums or wherever they're going to go, that right. can't be good for a region that's already, you know, seeing a massive spike up in terms of their COVID sickness. As you were saying, it's black swan after black swan. I really do believe still that we are going to see, you know, September and October be the reckoning. In terms of reckoning, let me just also say about the U.S. dollar and the reserve currency. So when Janet Yellen says we're going to pour it on, the truth of the matter is that the United States, the Fed did not really pour it on relative to other central banks. If you think about where the U.S. was in terms of the yield curve, the steepness of the yield curve, and why it was there up until the pandemic, it was because Jay Powell, he was raising rates. No one else was raising rates. The United States was raising rates. And in fact, Jay Powell in 2018 raised rates four times when at the beginning of the year he was signaling that he was going to raise it three times. The market thought he was going to raise it two. So the market moved to three, which is where the Fed said they were going to be. And then he raised it one more. That's when we had the accident at the end. And then since then, we've had the reversal of Fed policy. But that's only dollar bullish in general. So to the degree that we're moving back to that norm, where you're not getting a lot of impulse relative to other countries, I'm not really that negative on the dollar here as a lot of people are. I think that we're at the end, the bottom of a trading range for the dollar, especially against the euro, and that the impulse for the dollar is higher from this point.
Yeah, and as we've said so many times before, DXY is basically a proxy against the euro to 92.9 today. You know, Ed, so many important points there. And it really does start to feel now as we head into, frankly, the time frame that you've been expressing from the very beginning of this here at the end of August, it really does feel like an inflection point, a very difficult time for the people who are in the Gulf right now. You know, there was an article I was reading, I think it was yesterday, about how a single super spreader event in the Boston area may have been the trigger for a substantial proportion of the U.S. spread of COVID in the first place. And when you think back to those terrible images that we saw coming out of Katrina, people huddled in high school gymnasiums and that sort of thing, it's really difficult under such difficult and frankly painful circumstances to even think about maintaining the kind of social distancing that we've used to flatten the curve and get things under control. An uncertain time, a difficult time, and a lot of uncertainty quavering on the horizon.
Yeah. And, you know, at the risk of being very U.S. centric in this particular video that we're doing, I think that's where the action is right now. The action is in terms of, you know, what's happening in the U.S. relative to what's happening elsewhere, because even though you have coronavirus cases increasing in Europe, you know, you have the fiscal stimulus still flowing in most of those countries. Germany just released more fiscal stimulus. It's pretty much par for the course, you know, steady as she goes there relative to what's happening in the U.S. I think the U.S. is where the rubber hits the road in terms of volatility in asset markets in September and October. And the reason is that, you know, the preconditions, both politically and economically, are there for you to have a black swan, you know, give you some adverse downside risk.
Yeah. And also at risk of sounding a little bit U.S.-centric for our friends and subscribers who are out in the Gulf, please take care of yourselves.
Well said.
Ed, as always, a pleasure to have this conversation with you. I wish we had better news and better tidings and better news on the horizon.
Yeah, myself as well. And I just have to echo what you said. You know, I hope all is well with our friends in the Gulf.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.